Ohio seniors, it's time to make the right call for better Medicare benefits with Medical Mutual. Plans start at $0 per month and include $0 doctor visits and $0 generic prescription drugs. Visit medmutual.com/review or call 1-866-966-9338 to find a plan today. MedMutual Advantage plans are HMO, HMO, POS, and PPO plans offered by Medical Mutual of Ohio with a Medicare contract. Enrollment in a MedMutual Advantage plan depends on contract renewal.
Chapter 10 of Mary Louise by L. Frank Baum. Read for LibriVox.org into the public domain. Chapter 10. Rather queer, indeed. Mary Louise found the door of the office, which was located on the third floor of the Chambers building, locked. However, the sign Peter Conant, attorney at law, was painted on the glass panel in big, distinct letters, so she was sure she had made no mistake. She slowly paced the hall, waiting until the elevator stopped and Mr. Conant stepped out and approached the door, his morning paper in one hand, a key in the other. Running to him, the girl exclaimed, "Oh, Mr. Conant!" He stopped short and turned to face her. Then he stepped a pace backwards and said, "Great heavens, it's Mary Louise!" "Didn't you recognize me?" she asked. "Not at first," he answered slowly. "You've grown tall and older in 2 years. Where is Grandpa Hush!" With a startled glance up and down the hall, then he unlocked the door and added, "Come in." Mary Louise followed him through the outer office and into a smaller room beyond, the door of which Mr. Conant carefully closed after them. Then he turned to look steadily at the girl, who thought he did not seem especially delighted at her appearance in Dorfield. Indeed, his first words proved this, for he asked sternly, "Why are you here?" "I left the school at Beverly because the girls made it so uncomfortable for me that I could not bear it any longer," she explained. "In what way did they make it uncomfortable for you?" "They jeered at me because Grandpa Jim is being hunted by the officers of the law, who accuse him of doing something wicked." Mr. Conant frowned. "Perhaps their attitude was only natural," he remarked. "But there was no accusation against you, my child. Why didn't you stick it out? The scandal would soon have died away and left you in peace." "I was unhappy there," she said simply, "and so I thought I would come here to Mother and Grandpa Jim." "Here?" as if surprised. "Yes, aren't they here with you?" "No." "Then where are they?"
"I've no idea."
She sat still and stared at him, while he regarded her with a thoughtful and perplexed look on his face. Mr. Conant is difficult to describe, because he was like dozens of men one meets every day, at least in outward appearance. He was neither tall nor short, lean nor fat, handsome nor ugly, attractive nor repulsive. Yet Peter Conant must not be considered a nonentity because he was commonplace in person, for he possessed mannerisms that were peculiar. He would open his eyes very wide and stare at one steadily, until the person became confused and turned away. The gaze was not especially shrewd, but it was disconcerting because steadfast. When he talked, he would chop off his words one by one, with a distinct pause between each, and that often made it hard to tell whether he had ended his speech or still had more to say. When very earnest or interested, he would play with a locket that dangled from his watch-chain. Otherwise, he usually stood with his hands clasped behind his back. Mary Louise well knew these peculiarities, having previously lived in his house, and also she knew that he was a kind-hearted man, devotedly attached to his deaf wife, and thoroughly trusted by Grandpa Jim. "I was told," said the girl presently, "to direct all my letters to my grandfather in your care."
"I am aware that you have done so," he replied.
"So I thought, of course, that he and my mother were here with you." "No, they did not come to me. Colonel Weatherby arranged for me to forward your letters, which I did as soon as they arrived."
"Oh, then you know his address?"
"I do not. There are 6 different points to which I forward letters, in rotation, both those from you and from others on various matters of business, and these points are widely scattered. My impression is that Colonel Weatherby is in none of these places, and that the letters are again forwarded to him, to wherever he may be."
Mary Louise felt quite discouraged. With hesitation she asked, "Do you suppose you could find him for me?"
"It is impossible."
"What am I to do, Mr. Conant?"
"I advise you to go back to your school."
"Can't I stay here with you?"
He stared at her with his round eyes playing with his locket.
"I haven't the money for the return trip," she went on falteringly. "I had to sell some of my jewelry to get here. I won't be much trouble if you will let me live with you until I can find Grandpa Jim."
Mr. Conant still stared.
"'I'm sure,' said Mary Louise, "'that my grandfather will gladly repay you any money it costs you to keep me.'
"'You don't understand,' he retorted, chopping off his words rather viciously. "'Moreover, you can't understand. Go to the house and talk to Hannah. Have you any baggage?'
"'I've a suitcase at the hotel,' she said, and went on to tell him the experiences of her journey and of her encounter with Detective O'Gorman. During this relation, which he did not interrupt, Mr. Conant toyed persistently with his watch-charm. His features were noncommittal, but he was thoroughly interested. "'You see,' he remarked when she had finished, "'Colonel Weatherby's elaborate system of evading discovery is quite necessary.'
"'But why should he wish to hide?' asked the girl.
"'Don't you know?'
"'No, sir.'
"'Then your grandfather doesn't wish you to know. I am his lawyer. At least, I am one of his lawyers, and a lawyer must respect the confidences of his clients.' Mary Louise looked at him wonderingly, for here was someone who evidently knew the entire truth.
"'Do you believe my grandfather is a bad man?' she asked.
"'No. I have the highest respect for Colonel Weatherby.
Do you know his name to be Weatherby, or is it Hathaway?'
"'I am his lawyer,' reiterated Mr. Conant.
"'Is it possible that an innocent man would change his name and hide, rather than face an unjust accusation?'
"'Yes.' Mary Louise sighed. "'I will go with you to the hotel and pay your bill,' said the lawyer. "'Then you may go to the house and talk to Hannah. When I have talked with her myself, we will determine what to do with you.' So they went to the hotel, and the girl packed her suitcase and brought it downstairs. "'Queer,' said Mr. Conant to her, fingering his locket. "'Your bill has been paid by that man O'Gorman.'
"'How impertinent!' she exclaimed.
"'There is also a note for you in your box.' The clerk handed her an envelope, which she opened. "'I hope to be able to send you your grandfather's address very soon,' wrote O'Gorman. "'You will probably stay in Dorfield, perhaps with the Conants with whom you lived before. You might try sending Colonel Weatherby a letter in care of Oscar Lawler at Los Angeles, California. In any event, don't forget my card or neglect to wire me in case of emergency.' Having read this with considerable surprise, the girl handed the note to Mr. Conant, who slowly read it and gave a bark like that of an angry dog when he came to the name of the California attorney. Without remark, he put the detective's letter in his pocket and, picking up Mary Louise's suitcase, led the girl out to the street corner. "'This car will take you to within 2 blocks of my house,' he said. "'Can you manage your grip alone?'
"'Easily,' she assured him.
"'You have car fare?'
"'Yes, thank you.'
"'Then goodbye. I'll see you this evening.' He turned away, and she boarded the streetcar. End of Chapter 10. Read by Sibella Denton. For more free audiobooks or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org.
Chapter 11 of Mary Louise by L. Frank Baum. Read for LibriVox.org into the public domain. Chapter 11. Mary Louise meets Irene. As Mary Louise approached the home of the Conants, which was a pretty little house set far back in a garden filled with trees and shrubs, she was surprised to hear a joyous ragtime tune being drummed upon the piano, an instrument she remembered Mrs. Conant kept in the house exclusively as an ornament, being unable to play it. Then, as the girl reached the porch, the melody suddenly stopped, a merry laugh rang out, and a fresh, sweet voice was heard through the open window, talking rapidly and with eager inflection. "'I wonder who that can be,' thought Mary Louise. Everyone had to speak loudly to poor Mrs. Conant, who might be entertaining a visitor. She rang the bell, and soon her old friend appeared in the doorway. "'My dear, dear child!' cried the good lady, recognizing the girl instantly and embracing her after a welcoming kiss. "'Where on earth have you come from?'
"'From Beverly,' said Mary Louise with a smile, for in her depressed state of mind this warm greeting cheered her wonderfully.
"'Come right in,' said Mrs. Conant, seizing the suitcase. "'Have you had breakfast?'
"'Yes, indeed, hours ago. And I've seen Mr. Conant at his office. He wanted me to talk to you.'
She spoke loudly, as she had been accustomed to do, but now Mrs. Conant wore on her ear an instrument similar in appearance to a small telephone receiver, and she seemed to hear quite distinctly through its mechanism. Indeed, she pointed to it with an air of pride and said, "'I can hear a whisper, my dear.'
As Mary Louise was ushered into the cozy sitting-room, she looked for the piano player and the owner of the merry laugh and cheery voice. Near the center of the room was a wheeled chair in which sat a young girl of about her own age, a rather pretty girl in spite of her thin frame and pallid countenance. She was neatly dressed in figure dimity, with a bright ribbon at her throat.
A pair of expressive brown eyes regarded Mary Louise with questioning earnestness. Over her lap lay a coverlet. Her slender white fingers rested upon the broad arms of her chair. "This," said Mrs. Conant, "is my niece, Irene MacFarlane, who is living with us just now and is the life and joy of our formerly dull household. You'll have to love her, Mary Louise, because no one can help doing so." Mary Louise advanced to the chair and took one of the wan hands in her own. A thrill of pity flooded her heart for the unfortunate girl, who instantly noted her expression and met it with a charmingly spontaneous smile. "Don't you dare think of me as a cripple," she said warningly. "I am not at all helpless, and my really truly friends quickly forget this ugly wheeled chair. We are to be friends, are we not? And you're going to stay because I see your baggage. Also, I know all about you, Mary Louise Burroughs, for Aunt Hannah never tires of singing your praises." This was said so naturally and with such an air of affection that Mary Louise could not fail to respond to the words and smile. "I'm glad to find you here, Irene," she said, "and I don't know yet whether I'm to stay or not. That will depend on Mrs. Conant's decision." "Then you're to stay," promptly decided the hospitable lady, who by turning her mechanical ear toward the speaker seemed to be able to hear her words clearly. "But you don't know all the complications yet," confessed the girl. "I've run away from school, and there are other things you must know before you decide. Mr. Conant wasn't at all enthusiastic over my coming here, I assure you, so I must tell you frankly the whole story of my adventures." "Very good," returned Mrs. Conant. "I think I can guess at most of the story, but you shall tell it in your own way. Presently Irene is going out to inspect the roses. She does that every morning, so when she is out of the way we'll have a nice talk together." "I'm going now," said Irene, with a bright laugh at her dismissal. "Mary Louise won't be happy till everything is properly settled, nor will I, for I'm anxious to get acquainted with my new friend. So here I go, and when you've had your talk out, just whistle for me, Mary Louise." She could propel the chair by means of rims attached to the wheels, and even as she spoke, began to roll herself out of the room. Mary Louise sprang to assist her, but the girl waved her away with a little laugh. "I'm an expert traveler," she said, "and everyone lets me go and come as I please. Indeed, I'm very independent, Mary Louise, as you will presently discover." Away she went, through the hall, out the front door, and along the broad porch, and when she had gone, Mary Louise whispered softly into Mrs. Conant's mechanical eardrum, "What is wrong with her?" "A good many things," was the reply, "although the brave child makes light of them all. One leg is badly withered, and the foot of the other is twisted out of shape. She can stand on that foot to dress herself, which she insists on doing unaided, but she cannot walk a step. Irene has suffered a great deal, I think, and she's a frail little body, but she has the sweetest temperament in the world, and seems happy and content from morn till night." "It's wonderful," exclaimed Mary Louise. "What caused her affliction?" "It is the result of an illness she had when a baby. Irene is 16, and has never known what it is to be well and strong, yet she never resents her fate, but says she is grateful for the blessings she enjoys. Her father died long ago, and her mother about a year since. So, the child being an orphan, Peter and I have taken her to live with us." "That is very kind of you," asserted Mary Louise, with conviction. "No, I fear it is pure selfishness," returned the good woman, "for until she came to us the old home had been dreadfully dull, the result, my dear, of your going away. And now tell me your story, and all about yourself, for I am anxious to hear what brought you to Dorfield." Mary Louise drew a chair close to that of Aunt Hannah Conant, and confided to her all the worries and tribulations that had induced her to quit Miss Stern's school and seek shelter with her old friends the Conants. Also, she related the episode of Detective Gorman, and how she had first learned through him that her grandfather and mother were not living in Dorfield. "I'm dreadfully worried over Grandpa Jim," said she, "for those terrible agents of the Secret Service seem bent on catching him, and he doesn't wish to be caught. If they arrest him, do you think they would put him in jail, Aunt Hannah?" "I fear so," was the reply. "What do they imagine he has done that is wrong?" "I do not know," said Mrs. Conant. "Peter never tells me anything about the private affairs of his clients, and I never ask him. But of one thing I am sure, my dear, and that is that Peter Conant would not act as Colonel Weatherby's lawyer, and try to shield him, unless he believed him innocent of any crime. Peter is a little odd in some ways, but he's honest to the backbone." "I know it," declared Mary Louise. "Also I know that Grandpa Jim is a good man. Cannot the law make a mistake, Aunt Hannah?" "It surely can, or there would be no use for lawyers. "'But do not worry over your grandfather, my child, "'for he seems quite able to take care of himself. "'It is 9 or 10 years since he became a fugitive, "'also making a fugitive of your poor mother, "'who would not desert him, "'and to this day the officers of the law "'have been unable to apprehend him. "'Be patient, dear girl, and accept the situation as you find it. "'You shall live with us until your people again send for you. "'We have excellent schools in Dorfield, "'where you will not be taunted with your grandfather's misfortunes,' "'because no one here knows anything about them.' "'Doesn't Irene know?' asked Mary Louise. "'She only knows that your people are great travelers, "'and frequently leave you behind them as they flit from place to place. "'She knows that you lived with us for 3 years, and that we love you.' "'The girl became thoughtful for a time. "'I can't understand,' she finally said, "'why Grandpa Jim acts the way he does. "'Often he has told me, when I deserved censure, "'to face the music and have it over with.' Once he said that those who sin must suffer the penalty, because it is the law of both God and man, and he who seeks to escape a just penalty is a coward. Grandpa knows he is innocent, but the government thinks he is guilty, so why doesn't he face the music and prove his innocence, instead of running away as a coward might do, and so allow his good name to suffer reproach? Mrs. Conant shook her head as if perplexed. "'That very question has often puzzled me, as it has you,' she confessed. Once I asked Peter about it, and he scowled, and said it might be just as well to allow Colonel Weatherby to mind his own business. The Colonel seems to have a good deal of money, and perhaps he fears that if he surrendered to the law it would be taken away from him, leaving you and your mother destitute. "'We wouldn't mind that,' said the girl, "'if Grandpa's name could be cleared.' "'After all,' continued Mrs. Conant, reflectively, "'I don't believe the Colonel is accused of stealing money, for Peter says his family is one of the oldest and richest in New York.' Your grandfather inherited a vast fortune and added largely to it. Peter says he was an important man of affairs before this misfortune, whatever it was, overtook him. "'I can just remember our home in New York,' said Mary Louise, also musingly, "'for I was very young at the time. It was a beautiful big place, with a good many servants. I wonder what drove us from it.' "'Do you remember your father?' asked Mrs. Conant. "'Not at all.' "'Peter once told me he was a foreigner who fell desperately in love with your mother "'and married her without your grandfather's full approval. "'I believe Mr. Burroughs was a man of much political influence, "'for he served in the Department of State and had a good many admirers. "'Peter never knew why your grandfather opposed the marriage, "'for afterward he took Mr. and Mrs. Burroughs to live with him, "'and they were all good friends up to the day of your father's death. "'But this is ancient history, and speculation on subjects we do not understand "'is sure to prove unsatisfactory.' I wouldn't worry over your grandfather's troubles, my dear. Try to forget them. Grandfather's real name isn't Weatherby, said the girl. It is Hathaway. Mrs. Conant gave a start of surprise. How did you learn that? She asked sharply. The girl took out her watch, pried open the back eaves with the penknife, and allowed Mrs. Conant to read the inscription. Also, she curiously watched the woman's face, and noted its quick flush and its uneasy expression. Did the lawyer's wife know more than she had admitted? If so, why was everyone trying to keep her in the dark? "'I cannot see that this helps to solve the mystery,' said Mrs. Conant, in a brisk tone, as she recovered from her surprise. "'Let us put the whole thing out of mind, Mary Louise, or it will keep us all stirred up and in a muddle of doubt. I shall tell Peter you are to live with us, and your old little room at the back of the hall is all ready for you. Irene has the next room, so you will be quite neighborly.' "'Go and put away your things, and then we'll whistle for Irene.' Mary Louise went to the well-remembered room and slowly and thoughtfully unpacked her suitcase. She was glad to find a home again among congenial people, but she was growing more and more perplexed over the astonishing case of Grandpa Jim. It worried her to find that an occasional doubt would cross her mind, in spite of her intense loyalty to her dearly loved grandparent. She would promptly drive out the doubt, but it would insist on intruding again. "'Something is wrong somewhere,' she sighed. "'There must be some snarl that even Grandpa Jim can't untangle, "'and if he can't, I'm sure no one else can. "'I wish I could find him and that he would tell me all about it. "'I suppose he thinks I'm too young to confide in, "'but I'm almost 16 now, and surely that's old enough to understand things. "'There were girls at school 20 years old that I'm sure couldn't reason as well as I can.' "'After a while she went downstairs and joined Irene in the garden.' where the chair-girl was trimming rose-bushes with a pair of stout scissors. She greeted Mary Louise with her bright smile, saying, "'I suppose everything is fixed up now, and we can begin to get acquainted.' "'Why, we are acquainted,' declared Mary Louise. Until today I had never heard of you, and yet it seems as if I had known you always."
"Thank you," laughed Irene. "That is a very pretty compliment, I well realize. You have decided to stay, then?"
"Aunt Hannah has decided so, but Mr. Cannot may object."
"He won't do that," was the quick reply.
"Uncle Peter may be an autocrat in his office, but I've noticed that Aunt Hannah is the ruler of this household."
Mr. Cannot may have noticed that also, for he seemed not at all surprised when his wife said she had decided to keep Mary Louise with them. But after the girls had gone to bed that night, the lawyer had a long talk with his better half, and thereafter Mary Louise's presence was accepted as a matter of course. But Mr. Cannot said to her the next morning, "I have notified your grandfather, at his 6 different addresses, of your coming to us, so I ought to receive his instructions within the next few days. Also, today I will write Miss Stern that you are here, and why you came away from the school."
"Will you ask her to send my trunk?"
"Not now. We will first await advices from Colonel Weatherby." These advices were received 3 days later in the form of a brief telegram from a Los Angeles attorney. The message read, "Colonel Weatherby requests you to keep M.L. in Dorfield until further instructions. Money forwarded. Hot. Caution." It was signed O.L., and when Mr. Cannot showed Mary Louise the message, she exclaimed,
"Then Mr. O'Gorman was right."
"In what way?" questioned the lawyer.
"In the note he left for me at the hotel. He said I might find my grandfather by writing to Oscar Lawyer at Los Angeles, California. This telegram is from Los Angeles, and it is signed O.L., which must mean Oscar Lawyer."
"How clever!" said Mr. Cannot sarcastically.
"That proves, of course, that Grandpa Jim and Mother are in California. But how did the detective know that?" she asked wonderingly.
"He didn't know it," asked Peter Cannot. "On the contrary, this message proves to me that they are not there at all."
"But the telegram says—"
"Otherwise," continued the lawyer, "the telegram would not have come from that far-away point on the Pacific coast. There now remain 5 other places where Colonel Weatherby might be located. The chances are, however, that he is not in any of them." Mary Louise was puzzled. It was altogether too bewildering for her comprehension.
"Here are 2 strange words," said she, eyeing the telegram she still held. "What does hot mean, Mr. Cannot?"
"It means," he replied, "that the government spies are again seeking Colonel Weatherby. The word caution means that we must all take care not to let any information escape us that might lead to his arrest. Don't talk to strangers, Mary Louise. Don't talk to anyone outside our family of your grandfather's affairs, or even of your own affairs. The safety of Colonel Weatherby depends, to a great extent, on our all being silent and discreet."
End of chapter 11. Read by Sibella Denton. For more free audiobooks or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Chapter 12 of Mary Louise by L. Frank Baum. Read for LibriVox.org into the public domain. Chapter 12. A Cheerful Comrade. The more Mary Louise saw of Irene McFarlane, the more she learned to love her. No one could be miserable or despondent for long in the chair girl's society, because she was always so bright and cheery herself. One forgot to pity or even to deplore her misfortunes while listening to her merry chatter and frank laughter, for she seemed to find genuine joy and merriment in the simplest incidents of the life about her.
"God has been so good to me, Mary Louise," she once exclaimed as they were sitting together in the garden. "He has given me sight, that I may revel in bookland and in the beauties of flowers and trees, and shifting skies and the faces of my friends. He has given me the blessing of hearing, that I may enjoy the strains of sweet music and the songs of the birds and the voices of those I love. And I can scent the fragrance of the morning air, the perfume of the roses, and, yes, even the beefsteak Aunt Hannah is frying for supper. The beefsteak tastes as good to me as it does to you. I can feel the softness of your cheek. I can sing melodies in my own way, whenever my heart swells with joy. I can move about, by means of this wonderful chair, without the bother of walking. You don't envy me, Mary Louise, because you enjoy almost equal blessings, but you must admit I have reason for being happy." Irene read a good many books and magazines, and through the daily papers kept well posted on the world's affairs. Indeed, she was much better posted than Mary Louise, who, being more active, had less leisure to think and thus absorb the full meaning of all that came to her notice. Irene would play the piano for hours at a time, though obliged to lean forward in her chair to reach the keys, and her moods ran the gamut from severely classical themes to ragtime, seeming to enjoy all equally. She also sewed and mended with such consummate skill that Mary Louise, who was rather awkward with her needle, marveled at her talent.
Nor was this the end of the chair-girl's accomplishments, for Irene had a fancy for sketching and made numerous caricatures of those persons with whom she came in contact. These contained so much humor that Mary Louise was delighted with them, especially one of Uncle Peter toying with his watch-fob and staring straight ahead of him with round, expressionless eyes. "Really, Irene, I believe you could paint," she once said. "No," answered her friend, "I would not be so wicked as to do that. All imitations of nature seem to me a mock of God's handiwork, which no mortal brush can hope to equal. I shall never be so audacious, I hope. But a photograph is a pure reflex of nature, and my caricatures, which are merely bits of harmless fun, furnish us now and then a spark of humor to make us laugh, and laughter is good for the soul. I often laugh at my own sketches, as you know. Sometimes I laugh at their whimsical conception, before I ever put pencil to paper. Lots of caricatures I make secretly, laughing over and then destroying them for fear they might be seen and hurt the feelings of their innocent subjects. Why, Mary Louise, I drew your doleful face only yesterday, and it was so funny I shrieked with glee. You heard me and looked over at me with a smile that made the caricature lie, so I promptly tore it up. It had served its purpose, you see." So many of these quaint notions filled the head of the crippled girl that Mary Louise's wondering interest in her never flagged. It was easy to understand why Mrs. Conant had declared that Irene was the joy and life of the household, for it was impossible to remain morbid or blue in her presence. For this reason, as well as through the warm and sincere affection inspired by Irene, Mary Louise came by degrees to confide to her the entire story of the mystery that surrounded her grandfather and influenced the lives of her mother and herself. Of her personal anxieties and fears she told her new friend far more than she had ever confessed to anyone else, and her disclosures were met by ready sympathy. "Pooh!" cried Irene. "This isn't a real trouble. It will pass away. Everything passes away in time, Mary Louise, for life is a succession of changes, one thing after another. Remember the quotation, 'Whate'er may be thy fate today, remember, this will pass away.' I love that little saying, and it has comforted me and given me courage many a time." "Life will also pass away," observed Mary Louise, pessimistically. "To be sure! Isn't that a glad prospect? To pass to a new life, to new adventures, planned for us by the wisdom of God, is the most glorious promise we mortals possess. In good time that joy will be ours, but now we must make the most of our present blessings. I take it, Mary Louise, that there is a purpose in everything, a divine purpose, you know, and that those who most patiently accept their trials will have the better future recompense. What's a twisted ankle or a shriveled leg to do with happiness, or even a persecuted grandfather? We're made of better stuff, you and I, than to cry at such babyish bumps. My, what a lot of things we both have to be thankful for!" Somehow these conversations cheered Mary Louise considerably, and her face soon lost its drawn, worried look, and became almost as placid as in the days when she had Grandpa Jim beside her, and suspected no approaching calamity. Grandpa Jim would surely have loved Irene, had he known her, because their ideas of life and duty were so similar. As it was now less than a month to the long summer vacation, Mary Louise did not enter the Dorfield High School, but studied a little at home, so as not to get rusty, and passed most of her days in the society of Irene McFarland. It was a week or so after her arrival that Peter Conant said to her one evening, "I have now received ample funds for all your needs, Mary Louise, so I have sent to Miss Stern to have your trunk and books forwarded." "Oh, then you have heard from Grandpa Jim?" she asked eagerly.
"Yes."
"Where is he?"
"I do not know," chopping the words apart with emphasis.
"The colonel has been very liberal. I am to put $20 in cash in your pocketbook, and you are to come to me for any further sums you may require, which I am ordered to supply without question. I would have favored making you an allowance, had I been consulted, but the colonel is the colonel is the colonel."
"Didn't Grandpa Jim send me any letter or any information at all?" she asked wistfully.
"Not a word."
"In my last letter, which you promised me to forward, I begged him to write me," she said with disappointment.
Peter Conant made no reply. He merely stared at her. But afterward, when the two girls were alone, Irene said to her,
"I do not think you should beg your grandfather to write for you. A letter might be traced by his enemies, you know, and that would mean his undoing. He surely loves you and bears you in mind, for he has provided for your comfort in every possible way. Even your letters to him may be dangerous, although they reach him in such roundabout ways. If I were you, Mary Louise, I'd accept the situation as I found it, and not demand more than your grandfather and your mother are able to give you." This frank advice Mary Louise accepted in good part, and through the influence of the chair girl, she gradually developed a more contented frame of mind. Irene was a persistent reader of books, and one of Mary Louise's self-imposed duties was to go to the public library and select such volumes as her friend was likely to be interested in. These covered a wide range of subjects, although historical works and tales of the age of chivalry seemed to appeal to Irene more than any others. Sometimes she would read aloud, in her sweet, sympathetic voice, to Mary Louise and Mrs. Conant, and under these conditions they frequently found themselves interested in books which, if read by themselves, they would be sure to find intolerably dry and uninteresting. The crippled girl had a way of giving more than she received, and instead of demanding attention, would often entertain the sound-limbed ones of her immediate circle. End of chapter 12. Read by Sibella Denton. For more free audiobooks or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Chapter 13 of Mary Louise by L. Frank Baum. Read for LibriVox.org into the public domain. Chapter 13. Bub Succumbs to Force. One day Peter Conant abruptly left his office, came home and packed his grip, and then hurried downtown and caught the 5 o'clock train for New York. He was glum and uncommunicative, as usual, merely telling Aunt Hannah that business called him away, and he did not know when he would be back. A week later Peter appeared at the family breakfast table, having arrived on the early morning express, and he seemed in a more gracious mood than usual. Indeed, he was really talkative. "I met Will Morrison in New York, Hannah," he said to his wife. "He was just sailing for London with his family, and will remain abroad all summer. He wanted us to occupy his mountain place, Hillcrest Lodge, during July and August, and although I told him we couldn't use the place, he insisted on my taking an order on his man to turn the shack over to us." "The shack?" cried Aunt Hannah indignantly. "Why, Peter, Hillcrest Lodge is a little palace. It is the cosiest, most delightful place I have ever visited. Why shouldn't we accept Will Morrison's proposition to occupy it?" "I can't leave my business." "You could run up every Friday afternoon, taking the train to Millbank and the stage to Hillcrest, and stay with us till Monday morning." He stared at her reflectively. "Would you be safe in that out-of-the-way place?" he asked. "Of course. Didn't you say Will had a man for caretaker? And only a few scattered cottages are located nearby, so we shall be quite by ourselves and wholly unmolested. I mean to go and take the girls. The change will do us all good, so you may as well begin to make arrangements for the trip." Peter Conant stared a while and then resumed his breakfast without comment. Mary Louise thought she saw a smile flicker over his stolid features for a moment, but could not be positive. Aunt Hannah had spoken in a practical, matter-of-fact way that did not admit of argument. "Let me see," she resumed. "We will plan to leave on Thursday morning, over the branch road, which will get us to Millbank by noon. If you telegraph the stage driver to meet us, we can reach Hillcrest Lodge by 3 o'clock, perhaps earlier, and that will enable us to get settled before dark. That is far better than taking the afternoon train. Will you make the proper arrangements, Peter?" "Yes," he briefly replied. As he was leaving the house after breakfast, he fixed his stare on Irene and said to her, "In New York I ran across a lot of second-hand books at an auction sale, old novels and romances which you will probably like. I bought the lot and shipped them home. If they arrive in time, you can take them to Hillcrest, and they will keep you reading all summer."
"Oh, thank you, Uncle Peter," exclaimed the chair girl gratefully. "Have you any news of Grandpa Jim?" asked Mary Louise diffidently.
"No," he said, and walked away. During the few days that remained before their exodus, they were busy preparing for the anticipated vacation. Summer gowns had to be looked over, and such things gathered together as might be useful during their 2 months' stay at Hillcrest. "Of course no one will see us," remarked Aunt Hannah. "It's really the jumping-off place of the world. But Will Morrison has made it as cozy as possible, and we three, with just Peter at the weekends, can amuse one another without getting lonely. Peter will fish in the mountain streams, of course, and that's the reason he is allowing us to go. We've visited the Morrisons 2 or 3 times at the lodge, and Peter has fished for trout every minute he was there."
"Who are the Morrisons?" asked Mary Louise.
"Will Morrison is a rich banker, and his wife Sally was an old schoolmate of mine. The lodge is only a little resort of theirs, you know, for in the city they live in grand style. I know you girls will enjoy the place, for the scenery is delightful and the clear mountain air mighty invigorating." All girls delight in change of location, and although Irene was a little worried over the difficulties of getting to Hillcrest Lodge in her crippled condition, she was as eager to go as was Mary Louise, and she made the trip more comfortably than she had feared. At Millbank the stage-driver fixed a comfortable seat for her in his carry-all, and loaded the boxes and baggage in the wheeled chair and the box of books, which had arrived from New York, on the railed top of his bus, and then they drove away through a rough but picturesque country that drew from the girls many exclamations of delight. Presently they came to a small group of dwellings called the Huddle, which lay at the foot of the mountain. Then up a winding path the four horses labored patiently, halting often to rest and get their breaths. At such times the passengers gloried in the superb views of the valley and its farms, and were never impatient to proceed. They passed one or two modest villas, for this splendid location had long ago been discovered by a few others besides Will Morrison, who loved to come here for their vacations, and so to escape the maddening crowds of the cities. Aunt Hannah had planned the trip with remarkable accuracy, for at about 3 o'clock the lumbering stage stopped at a pretty chalet, half hidden among the tall pines, and overlooking a steep bluff. Here the baggage and boxes were speedily unloaded. "I got to get back to meet the afternoon train," said Bill Coombs, their driver. "They won't be any more passengers in this direction, 'tain't likely, 'cause the houses round here is mighty scattered, and no one's expecting nobody, as I know of. But in the other direction from Millbank, Sod Corners way, I may catch a load if I'm lucky." So back he drove, leaving the Connaught's traps by the roadside, and Peter began looking around for Morrison's man. The doors of the house were fast locked, front and rear. There was no one in the barn or the shed-like garage, where a rusty-looking automobile stood. Peter looked round the grounds in vain. Then he whistled. Afterward he began bawling out, "Hi, there!" in a voice that echoed lonesomely throughout the mountainside. And at last, when they were all beginning to despair, a boy came slouching around a corner of the house, from whence no one could guess. He was whittling a stick, and he continued to whittle while he stared at the unexpected arrivals and slowly advanced. When about 15 paces away he halted, with feet planted well apart, and bent his gaze sturdily on his stick and knife. He was barefooted, dressed in faded blue jean overalls and a rusty gingham shirt, the two united by a strap over one shoulder, and his head was covered by a broad Scotch golf cap much too big for him, and considerably too warm for the season. "Come here," commanded Mr. Connaught. The boy did not move, therefore the lawyer advanced angrily toward him. "Why don't you obey me?" he asked. "They's gals there. I hates gals," said the boy in a confidential tone. "Any sort of men critters I can stand, but gals gets my goat." "Who are you?" inquired Mr. Connaught. "Me? I'm just Bub. Where is Mr. Morrison's man?" "Meanin' Talbot? Gone up to Mark's Peak to guide a gang of hunters from the city." "When did he go?" asked the lawyer. "I guess a Tuesday. No, a Wednesday." "And when will he be back?" The boy whittled abstractedly. "Answer me." "How can I? Do you know where Mark's Peak is?" "No. It takes a week to get there. They'll likely hunt 2 or 3 weeks, maybe more. You can tell that as well as I can. Master Will's gone to Europe with Miss Morrison, so Talbot he won't be in no hurry to come back." "Great Caesar! Here's a pretty mess. Are you Talbot's boy?" "Nope. I'm a Grigger, and I live over in the holler yonder."
"What are you doing here?"
"Earning 2 bits a week."
"How?"
"Looking after the place."
"Very well. Mr. Morrison has given us permission to use the lodge while he is away, so unlock the doors and help get the baggage in."
The boy notched the stick with his knife, using great care.
"Talbot didn't say nothing about that," he remarked composedly.
Mr. Connaught uttered an impatient ejaculation. It was one of his peculiarities to give a bark similar to that of a dog when greatly annoyed. After staring at the boy a while, he took out Will Morrison's letter to Talbot, opened it, and held it before Bub's face.
"Read that," he cried.
Bub grinned and shook his head.
"I can't read," he said.
Mr. Connaught, in a loud and severe voice, read Mr. Morrison's instruction to his man Talbot to do everything in his power to make the Connaughts comfortable, and to serve them as faithfully as he did his own master. The boy listened, whittling slowly. Then he said,
"Maybe that's all right, and again, maybe 'tain't. Seein' as I can't read, I ain't goin' to take no one's word for it."
"You insolent brat!" exclaimed Peter Connaught, highly incensed.
Then he turned and called, "Come here, Mary Louise." Mary Louise promptly advanced, and with every step she made, the boy retreated a like distance, until the lawyer seized his arm and held it in a firm grip. "What do you mean by running away?" he demanded. "I hates gals," retorted Bub sullenly. "Don't be a fool. Come here, Mary Louise, and read this letter to the boy word for word." Mary Louise, marking the boy's bashfulness and trying to restrain a smile, read Mr. Morrison's letter. "You see," said the lawyer sharply, giving Bub a little shake, "those are the exact words of the letter. We're going to enter the lodge and take possession of it, as Mr. Morrison has told us to do, and if you don't obey my orders I shall give you a good flogging. Do you understand that?" Bob nodded more cheerfully. "If you do it by force," said he, "that lets me out. Nobody can blame me if I'm forced." Mary Louise laughed so heartily that the boy cast an upward, half-approving glance at her face. Even Mr. Conant's stern visage relaxed. "See here, Bub," he said. "Obey my orders, and no harm can come to you. This letter is genuine, and if you serve us faithfully while we are here, I'll give you 4 bits a week."
"Heh! 4 bits?"
"Exactly. 4 bits every week."
"Gee, that'll make 6 bits a week, with the 2 Talbots going to give me. I'm hanged if I don't buy a sweater for next winter, afore the cold weather comes."
"Very good," said Mr. Conant. "Now get busy and let us in." Bub deliberately closed the knife and put it in his pocket, tossing away the stick. "Gals," he remarked, with another half-glance at Mary Louise, "ain't to my liking, but 4 bits!" He turned and walked away to where a wild rosebush clambered over one corner of the lodge. Pushing away the thick, thorny branches with care, he thrust in his hand and drew out a bunch of keys.
"If it's just the same to you, sir, I'd rather you snatch 'em from my hand," he suggested. "Then, if I'm blamed, I can prove a alibi."
Mr. Conant was so irritated that he literally obeyed the boy's request and snatched the keys. Then he led the way to the front door.
"It's that thin brass one," Bub hinted.
Mr. Conant opened the front door. The place was apparently in perfect order.
"Go and get Hannah and Irene, please," said Peter to Mary Louise, and soon they had all taken possession of the cozy lodge, had opened the windows and aired it, and selected their various bedrooms.
"It is simply delightful," exclaimed Irene, who was again seated in her wheeled chair. "And if Uncle Peter will build a little runway from the porch to the ground, as he did at home, I shall be able to come and go as I please."
Meantime, Aunt Hannah, as even Mary Louise now called Mrs. Conant, ransacked the kitchen and cupboards to discover what supplies were in the house. There was a huge stock of canned goods, which Will Morrison had begged them to use freely, and the Conants had brought a big box of other groceries with them, which was speedily unpacked. While the others were thus engaged in settling and arranging the house, Irene wheeled her chair to the porch, on the steps of which sat Bub, again whittling. He had shown much interest in the crippled girl, whose misfortune seemed instantly to dispel his aversion for her sex, at least so far as she was concerned. He was not reluctant even to look at her face, and he watched with astonishment the ease with which she managed her chair. Having overheard, although at a distance, most of the boy's former conversation with Uncle Peter, Irene now began questioning him.
"Have you been eating and sleeping here?"
"Of course," answered Bub.
"In the lodge?"
"No, over in Talbot's house. That's over the ridge yonder. It's only a step, but you can't see it from here. My home's in the South Holler, 4 mile away."
"Do you cook your own meals?"
"Nobody else to do it."
"And don't you get dreadfully lonesome at night?"
"Who, me? Guess not. What the Sam Hill is they to be lonesome over?"
"There are no neighbors near, are there?"
"Plenty. The Barker house is 2 mile one way, and the Bigby house is just 1/2 mile down the slope. Guess you passed it coming up. But they ain't no one in the Bigby house just now, 'cause Bigby got shot in the mountain last year, a deer huntin', and Bigby's wife married another man what says he's delicate and can't leave the city. But neighbors is plenty. 6 mile along the canyon lives Doolittle."
Irene was delighted with Bub's quaint language and ways, and before Mrs. Conant called her family to the simple, improvised dinner, the chair girl had won the boy's heart, and already they were firm friends. End of chapter 13. Read by Sibella Denton. For more free audiobooks or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Chapter 14 of Mary Louise by L. Frank Baum. Read for LibriVox.org into the public domain.
Chapter 14. A Call from Agatha Lord. Hillcrest Lodge was perched upon a broad shelf of the wooded mountain, considerably nearer to the bottom than to the top, yet a stiff climb from the plain below. Behind it was a steep cliff. In front there was a gradual descent covered with scrub, but affording a splendid view of the lowlands. At one side was the rocky canyon with its brook, struggling among the boulders, and on the other side the roadway that wound up the mountain in zigzag fashion, selecting the course of least resistance. Will Morrison was doubtless a mighty hunter and an expert fisherman, for the den at the rear of the lodge was a regular museum of trophies of the chase. Stag and doe heads, enormous trout mounted on boards, antlers of wild mountain sheep, rods, guns, revolvers, and hunting knives fairly lined the walls, while a cabinet contained reels, books of flies, cartridge belts, creels, and many similar articles. On the floor were rugs of bear, deer, and beaver. A shelf was filled with books on sporting subjects. There was a glass door that led into a little porch at the rear of the lodge, and a big window that faced the cliff. This sanctum of the owner rather awed the girls at first when they examined it, but they found it the most fascinating place in all the house, and Irene was delighted to be awarded the bedroom that adjoined it. The other bedrooms were on the upper floor. "However," said Mr. Cannot to Irene, "I shall reserve the privilege of smoking my evening pipe in this den, for here is a student lamp, a low table, and the easiest chairs in all the place. If you keep your bedroom door shut, you won't mind the fumes of tobacco." "I don't mind them anyhow, Uncle Peter," she replied. Bub Grigger helped get in the trunks and boxes. He also filled the wood box in the big living room, and carried water from the brook for Aunt Hannah, but otherwise he was of little use to them. His favorite occupation was whittling, and he would sit for hours on one of the broad benches overlooking the valley, aimlessly cutting chips from a stick without forming it into any object whatsoever. "I suppose all this time he is deeply thinking," said Mary Louise as the girls sat on the porch watching him, the day after their arrival, "but it would be interesting to know what direction Bub's thoughts take." "He must be figuring up his earnings and deciding how long it will take to buy that winter sweater," laughed Irene. "I've had a bit of conversation with the boy already, and his ideas struck me as rather crude and undeveloped." "One idea, however, is firmly fixed in his mind," declared Mary Louise. "He hates gals." "We must try to dispel that notion. Perhaps he has a big sister at home who pounds him, and therefore he believes all girls are alike." "Then let us go to him and make friends," suggested Mary Louise. "If we are gentle with the boy, we may win him over." Mr. Cannot had already made a runway for the chair, so they left the porch and approached Bub, who saw them coming and slipped into the scrub, where he speedily disappeared from view. At other times also he shyly avoided the girls, until they began to fear it would be more difficult to make friends than they had supposed. Monday morning Mr. Cannot went down the mountain road, valise in hand, and met Bill Coombs, the stage driver, at the foot of the descent, having made this arrangement to save time and expense. Peter had passed most of his 2 days' vacation in fishing, and had been so successful that he had promised Aunt Hannah he would surely return the following Friday. He had instructed Bub to take good care of the women folks during his absence, but no thought of danger occurred to any of them. The Morrisons had occupied the lodge for years, and had never been molested in any way. But the country people in the neighborhood were thoroughly honest and trustworthy. "There isn't much for us to do here," said Mary Louise when the three were left alone, "except to read, to eat, and to sleep. Lazy occupations all. I climbed the mountain a little way yesterday, but the view from the lodge is the best of all, and if you leave the road you tear your dress to shreds in the scrub." "Well, to read, to eat, and to sleep is the very best way to enjoy a vacation," asserted Aunt Hannah. "Let us all take it easy and have a good time." Irene's box of books, which Mr. Cannot had purchased for her in New York, had been placed in the den, where she could select the volumes as she chose, and the chair girl found the titles so alluring that she promised herself many hours of enjoyment while delving among them. They were all old and second-hand, perhaps fourth-hand or fifth-hand, as the lawyer had stated, and the covers were many of them torn to shatters. "But books is books," said Irene cheerily, and she believed they would not prove the less interesting in contents because of their condition. Mostly they were old romances, historical essays and novels, with a sprinkling of fairy tales and books of verse, just the subjects Irene loved most.
"Being exiles, if not regular hermits," observed the crippled girl, sunning herself on the small porch outside the den, book in hand, "we may loaf and dream to our heart's content, and without danger of reproach." But not for long were they to remain wholly secluded. On Thursday afternoon they were surprised by a visitor, who suddenly appeared from among the trees that lined the roadway, and approached the two girls who were occupying a bench at the edge of the bluff. The new arrival was a lady of singularly striking appearance, beautiful and in the full flush of womanhood, being perhaps 30 years of age. She wore a smart walking suit that fitted her rounded form perfectly, and a small hat, with a single feather, was jauntily perched upon her well-set head. Hair and eyes, almost black, contrasted finely with the bloom on her cheeks. In her ungloved hand she held a small walking-stick. Advancing with grace and perfect self-possession, she smiled and nodded to the two young girls, and then, as Mary Louise rose to greet her, she said, "I am your nearest neighbor, and so I have climbed up here to get acquainted. I am Agatha Lord, but of course you do not know me, because I came from Boston, whereas you came from... "Dorfield," said Mary Louise. "Pray be seated. Let me present Irene MacFarlane, and I am Mary Louise Burroughs. You are welcome, Miss Lord, or shall I say Mrs. Lord?" "Mrs. Correct," replied their visitor with a pleasant laugh, which brought an answering smile to the other faces. "But you must not address me, except as Agatha, for here in the wilderness formalities seem ridiculous. Now let us have a cozy chat together. Won't you come into the lodge and meet Mrs. Connaught?" "Not just yet. You may imagine how that climb winded me, although they say it is only half a mile. I've taken the Bigby house, just below you, you know, and I arrived there last night to get a good rest after a rather strenuous social career at home. Ever since Easter I've been on the go every minute, and I'm really worn to a frazzle." She did not look it, thought Mary Louise. Indeed, she seemed the very picture of health. "Ah," said she, fixing her eyes on Irene's book, "you are very fortunate. The one thing I forgot to bring with me was a supply of books, and there is not a volume, not even a prayer book, in the Bigby house. I shall go mad in these solitudes if I cannot read." "You may use my library," promised Irene, sympathizing with Miss Lord's desire. "Uncle Peter brought a great box of books for me to read, and you are welcome to share their delights with me. I believe there are 50 of them at the least, but many were published ages ago, and perhaps," with a glance at the dainty hands, "you won't care to handle second-hand books." "This isonic air will fumigate them," said Agatha Lord carelessly. "We don't absorb bindings, Irene, but merely the thoughts of the authors. Books are the one banquet table whereat we may feast without destroying the delicacy or flavor of the dishes presented. As long as the pages hold together, and the type is legible, a book is as good as when new." "I like pretty bindings, though," declared Irene, "for they dress pretty thoughts in fitting attire. An ill-looking book, whatever its contents, resembles the ugly girl whose only redeeming feature is her good heart. To be beautiful without and within must have been the desire of God in all things." Agatha gave her a quick look of comprehension. There was an unconsciously wistful tone in the girl's voice. Her face, though pallid, was lovely to view. Her dress was dainty and arranged with care. She earnestly sought to be as beautiful without and within as was possible, yet the twisted limbs forbade her attaining the perfection she craved. They sat together for an hour in desultory conversation, and Agatha Lord certainly interested the two younger girls very much. She was decidedly worldly in much of her gossip, but quick to perceive when she infringed the susceptibilities of her less sophisticated companions, and was able to turn the subject cleverly to more agreeable channels. "I've brought my automobile with me," said she, "and unless you have a car of your own, we will take some rides through the valley together. I mean to drive to Millbank every day for mail." "There's a car here, which belongs to Mr. Morrison," replied Mary Louise. "But as none of us understands driving it, we will gladly accept your invitations to ride. Do you drive your own car?" "Yes, indeed. That is the joy of motoring. And I care for my car, too, because the hired chauffeurs are so stupid. I didn't wish the bother of servants while taking my rest-cure, and so my maid and I are all alone at the Bigby place." After a time they went into the house, where Miss Lord was presented to Aunt Hannah, who welcomed their neighbour with her accustomed cordiality. In the den Agatha pounced upon the books, and quickly selected two which she begged permission to take home with her. "This is really a well-selected collection," she remarked, eyeing the titles critically. "Where did Mr. Connaught find it?" "At an auction of second-hand junk in New York," explained Irene.
"'Uncle Peter knows that I love old-fashioned books best, "'but I'm sure he didn't realize what a good collection this is.'
As she spoke, Irene was listlessly running through the leaves of two or three volumes she had not before examined, when in one of them her eye was caught by a yellowed sheet of correspondence paper, tucked among the pages at about midway between the covers. Without removing the sheet, she leaned over to examine the fine characters written upon it, and presently exclaimed, in wondering tones, "'Why, Mary Louise, here is an old letter about your mother. Yes, and here's something about your grandfather, too. How strange that it should be—' "'Let me see it!' cried Mary Louise, eagerly stretching out her hands. But over her friend's shoulder Irene caught the expression of Agatha Lord, tense, startled, with a gleam of triumph in the dark eyes. It frightened her, that look on the face of one she had deemed a stranger, and it warned her. She closed the book with a little slam of decision and tucked it beside her in her chair. "'No,' she said positively, "'no one shall see the letter until I've had time to read it myself.' "'But what was it about?' asked Mary Louise. "'I don't know yet, and you're not to ask questions until I do know,' retorted Irene, calmly returning Miss Lord's curious gaze while addressing Mary Louise. "'These are my books, you must admit, and so whatever I find in them belongs to me.'
"'Quite right, my dear,' approved Agatha Lord, with her light, easy laugh. She knew that Irene had surprised her unguarded expression, and wished to counteract the impression it had caused. Irene returned the laugh with one equally insincere, saying to her guest, "'Help yourself to whatever books you like, neighbor. Carry them home, read them, and return them at your convenience.' "'You are exceedingly kind,' answered Agatha, and resumed her examination of the titles. Mary Louise had not observed the telltale expression on Miss Lord's face, but she was shrewd enough to detect an undercurrent of ice in the polite phrases passing between her companions. She was consumed with curiosity to know more of the letter which Irene had found in the book, but did not again refer to it in the presence of their visitor. It was not long before Agatha rose to go, a couple of books tucked beneath her arm. "'Will you ride with me to Millbank tomorrow?' she asked, glancing from one face to another. Mary Louise looked at Irene, and Irene hesitated. "'I am not very comfortable without my chair,' she said. "'You shall have the rear seat all to yourself, and it is big and broad and comfortable. Mary Louise will ride with me in front. I can easily drive the car up here, and load you in at this very porch. Please come.' "'Very well, since you are so kind,' Irene decided, and after a few more kindly remarks the beautiful Miss Lord left them, and walked with graceful, swinging stride down the path to the road, and down the road toward the Bigby house. End of chapter 14. Read by Sibella Denton. For more free audiobooks or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Chapter 15 of Mary Louise by L. Frank Baum. Read for LibriVox.org into the public domain. Chapter 15. Bub's Hobby. When their visitor had departed, Mary Louise turned to her friend. "'Now, Irene, tell me about that queer letter,' she begged. "'Not yet, dear. I'm sure it isn't important, though it's curious to find such an old letter tucked away in a book Uncle Peter bought at an auction in New York, a letter that refers to your own people in days long gone by. In fact, Mary Louise, it was written so long ago that it cannot possibly interest us, except as proof of the saying that the world's a mighty small place. When I have nothing else to do, I mean to read that old epistle from start to finish. Then, if it contains anything you'd care to see, I'll let you have a look at it." With this promise, Mary Louise was forced to be content, for she did not wish to annoy Irene by further pleadings. It really seemed, on reflection, that the letter could be of little consequence to anyone. So she put it out of mind, especially as just now they spied Bub sitting on the bench, and whittling as industriously as ever. "'Let me go to him first,' suggested Irene, with a mischievous smile. "'He doesn't seem at all afraid of me, for some reason, and after I've let him into conversation you can join us.' So she wheeled her chair over to where the boy sat. He glanced toward her as she approached the bench, but made no movement to flee. "'We've had a visitor,' said the girl confidentially, "'a lady who has taken the Bigby house for the summer.' Bub nodded, still whittling. "'I know. I seen her drive her car up the grade on high,' he remarked, feeling the edge of his knife blade reflectively. "'Seems a real sport for a gal, don't she?'
"'She isn't a girl. She's a grown woman.'
"'To me,' said Bub, "'everything in skirts is gals. The older they gets, the more ornery, to my mind. Never seen a gal yet what's worth having round.'
"'Some day,' said Irene with a smile, "'you may change your mind about girls.'
"'And again,' said Bub, "'I mayn't. "'Dad says he were soft in the head when he took up with Mom, "'and Talbot owned a wife once what tried to pison him, "'so he'd give her the shake and come here to live in peace. "'But Dad's so used to scoldings "'that he can't sleep in the sound open any more "'unless he lays down beside the brook where it's noisiest. "'Then it reminds him of Mom, and he feels like he's to home. "'Gals think they got the men scared, and sometimes they guess right.' "'Even Miss Morrison makes Will toe the mark, "'and Miss Morrison ain't no slouch for a gal.'
"'This somewhat voluble screed was delivered slowly, "'interspaced with periods of aimless whittling, "'and when Irene had patiently heard it through, "'she decided it wise to change the subject. "'Tomorrow we are going to ride in Miss Lord's automobile,' she remarked. "'Bub grunted. "'She says she can easily run it up to our door. "'Do you believe that?' "'Why not?' he inquired. "'Don't Will Morrison have a car? "'It's over there in the shed now.' "'Could it be used?' quietly asked Mary Louise, who had now strolled up behind the bench unperceived. Bub turned a scowling face to her, but she was looking out across the bluff, and she had broached a subject in which the boy was intensely interested. "'That there car in there is a regular Hummer,' he asserted, waving the knife in one hand and the stick in the other by way of emphasis. "'Tain't much for looks, you know, but looks cuts no figure with machinery.' "'So long's it's well greased. "'On a hill, that there car's a cat. "'On a level stretch, she's a jack-rabbit. "'I've seen Will Morrison take her to Millbank and back in just an hour. "'Just one lonesome hour.' "'That must have been in its good days,' observed Mary Louise. "'The thing hasn't any tires on it now.'
"'Will takes the tires off every year, when he goes away, "'and puts them in the cellar,' explained Bob. "'They's 7 good tires down cellar now. "'I counted them the day afore you come here.'
"'In that case,' said Mary Louise, "'if any of us knew how to drive, we could use the car.'
"'Drive,' said Bub scornfully. "'That's nothing.'
"'Oh, do you know how?'
"'Me? I can drive any car that's on wheels. 2 years ago, afore Talbot came, I used to drive Will Morrison over to Millbank every week to catch the train, and bring the car home again, and went for Will when he come back.'
"'You must have been very young 2 years ago,' said Irene.
"'Shucks!' "'I'm going on 15 this very minute. "'When I were 11, I drove the Higgins car for him "'and never hit the ditch once. "'Young, what do you think I am, a kid?'
"'So indignant had he become "'that he suddenly rose and slouched away, "'nor could they persuade him to return. "'We're going to have a lot of fun with that boy "'once we learn how to handle him,' predicted Irene, "'when the two girls had enjoyed a good laugh at Bub's expense. "'He seems a queer mixture of simplicity and shrewdness.' The next day Agatha Lord appeared in her big touring car, and after lifting Irene in and making her quite comfortable in the back seat, they rolled gaily away to Millbank, where they had lunch at the primitive restaurant, visited the post office in the grocery store, and amused themselves until the train came in and brought Peter Connaught, who was loaded down with various parcels of merchandise Aunt Hannah had ordered. The lawyer was greatly pleased to find a car waiting to carry him to the lodge, and after being introduced to Miss Lord, whose loveliness he could not fail to admire, he rode back with her in the front seat, and left Mary Louise to sit inside with Irene in the packages. Bill Coombs didn't approve of this method of running his stage business, and scowled at the glittering auto as it sped away across the plain to the mountain. On this day Miss Lord proved an exceedingly agreeable companion to them all, even Irene forgetting for the time the strange expression she had surprised on Agatha's face at the time she found the letter. Mary Louise seemed to have quite forgotten that letter, for she did not again refer to it, but Irene, who had studied it closely in the seclusion of her own room that very night, had it rather persistently in mind, and her eyes took on an added expression of grave and gentle commiseration whenever she looked at Mary Louise's unconscious face. "'It is much more fun,' observed Peter Connaught at breakfast the next morning, "'to ride to and from the station in a motor-car than to patronize Bill Coombs's rickety, slow-going omnibus.' "'But I can't expect our fair neighbor to run a stage line for my express accommodation.' "'Will Morrison's car is here in the shed,' said Mary Louise, and then she told of their conversation with Bub concerning it. "'He says he has driven a car ever since he was 11 years old,' she added.
"'I was wondering what that boy was good for,' asserted the lawyer. "'Yet the very last thing I would have accused him of is being a chauffeur.'
"'Why don't you put on the tires and use the car?' asked Aunt Hannah.
"'Hmm. "'Morrison didn't mention the car to me. I suppose he forgot it. But I'm sure he'd be glad to have us use it. I'll talk with the boy.'
Bub was found near the Talbot cottage in the gully. When Mr. Connaught and Mary Louise approached him,
soon after finishing their breakfast, he was, as usual, diligently whittling.
"They tell me you understand running Mr. Morrison's car," began the lawyer.
Bub raised his eyes a moment to the speaker's face, but deemed an answer unnecessary.
"Is that true?"
with an impatient inflection.
"Can run any car," said Bub.
"Very well. Show me where the tires are, and we will put them on. I want you to drive me to and from Millbank hereafter." Bub retained his seat and whistled.
"Have you got an order from Will Morrison in writing?" he demanded.
"No, but he will be glad to have me use the machine. He said everything at the lodge was at my disposal."
"Cars," said Bub, "ain't like other things. A feller'll lend his hunting dog, or his knife, or his overcoat, but he's all fired shy lending his car. If I runned it for you, Will might blame me."
Mr. Cannot fixed his dull stare on the boy's face, but Bub went on whittling. However, in the boy's inmost heart was a keen desire to run that motor car, as had been proposed. So he casually remarked,
"If you forced me, you know, I'd just have to do it. Even Will couldn't blame me if I was forced."
Mr. Cannot was so exasperated that the hint was enough. He seized the boy's collar, lifted him off the stump, and kicked him repeatedly as he propelled his victim toward the house.
"Oh, Uncle Peter!" cried Mary Louise, distressed.
But Peter was obdurate, and Bub never whimpered. He even managed to close his knife between kicks and slip it into his trouser pocket. When they came to the garage, the lawyer halted, more winded than Bub, and demanded sharply, "What is needed to put the car in shape to run?"
"Tires, gasoline, oil, and water."
"The tires are in the cellar, you say? Get them out, or I'll skin you alive." Bub nodded, grinning.
"Forcin' of me afore a witness lets me out," he remarked cheerfully, and straightway went for the tires.
Irene wheeled herself out and joined Uncle Peter and Mary Louise in watching the boy attach the tires, which were on demountable rims and soon put in place. All were surprised at Bub's sudden exhibition of energy and his deft movements, for he worked with the assurance of a skilled mechanic.
"Now we need gasoline," said Mr. Cannot. "I must order that from Millbank, I suppose."
"Unless you want to rob Will Morrison's tank," agreed Bub.
"Oh, he has a tank of gasoline here?"
Bub nodded.
"An underground steel tank. I don't know how much gas is in it, but if you forced me, I'd have to measure it."
Peter picked up a stick and shook it threateningly, whereat Bub smiled and walked to the rear of the garage, where an iron plug appeared just above the surface of the ground. This he unscrewed with a wrench, thrust in a rod, and drew it out again.
"About 40 gallon," he announced. "That's enough for a starter, I guess."
"Then put some of it into the machine. Is there any oil?"
"Plenty oil."
Half an hour later, Bub started the engine and rolled the car slowly out of its shed to the graveled drive in the back yard.
"All right, mister," he announced with satisfaction. "I don't know what Will'll say to this, but I can prove I were forced. Want to take a ride now?"
"No," replied Mr. Cannot. "I merely wanted to get the car in shape. You are to take me to the station on Monday morning. Under the circumstances, we will not use Morrison's car for pleasure rides, but only for convenience in getting from here to the trains and back. He surely cannot object to that." Bub seemed disappointed by this decision. He ran the car around the yard 2 or 3 times, testing its condition, and then returned it to its shed. Mr. Cannot got his rod and reel and departed on a fishing excursion. End of chapter 15. Read by Sibella Denton. For more free audiobooks or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Chapter 16 of Mary Louise by L. Frank Baum. Read for LibriVox.org into the public domain. Chapter 16. The Stolen Book. Miss Lord came up to the lodge that Saturday forenoon, and proved so agreeable to Aunt Hannah and the girls that she was invited to stay to lunch. Mr. Cannot was not present, for he had put a couple of sandwiches in his pocket, and would not return home until dinner-time. After luncheon they were all seated together on the benches at the edge of the bluff, which had become their favorite resort because the view was so wonderful. Mary Louise was doing a bit of fancy work, Irene was reading, and Aunt Hannah, as she mended stockings, conversed in a dulcetory way with her guest. "If you don't mind," said Agatha after a time, "I'll run in and get me a book. This seems the place and the hour for dreaming rather than gossip, and as we are all in a dreamy mood, a good old-fashioned romance seems to me quite fitting for the occasion." Taking permission for granted, she rose and sauntered toward the house. There was a serious and questioning look in Irene's eyes as they followed the graceful form of Miss Lord, but Mary Louise and Aunt Hannah paid no heed to their visitors going in to select a book. It seemed so natural a thing for her to do.
It was fully 15 minutes before Agatha returned, book in hand. Irene glanced at the title and gave a sigh of relief. Without comment, their guest resumed her seat, and soon appeared to be immersed in her volume. Gradually, the sun crossed the mountain and cast a black shadow over the plain below, a shadow which lengthened and advanced inch by inch, until it shrouded the landscape spread beneath them. "That is my sundial," remarked Mary Louise, dropping her needlework to watch the shifting scene. "When the shadow passes the huddle, it's 4 o'clock. By the time it reaches that group of oaks, it is 4:30. At 5 o'clock it touches the creek, and then I know it's time to help Aunt Hannah with the dinner." Agatha laughed. "Is it really so late?" she asked. "I see the shadow has nearly reached the brook." "Oh, I didn't mean—" "Of course not, but it's time I ran home just the same. My maid Susan is a perfect tyrant and scolds me dreadfully if I'm late. May I take this book home, Irene? I'll return the others I have borrowed tomorrow." "To be sure," answered Irene. "I'm rich in books, you know." When Miss Lord went away, the party broke up, for Aunt Hannah was already thinking of dinner, and Mary Louise wanted to make one of Uncle Peter's favorite desserts. So Irene wheeled her chair into the house, and entering the den began a sharp inspection of the place, having in mind exactly the way it had looked when last she left it. But presently she breathed a sigh of relief and went into her own room, for the den had not been disturbed. She wheeled herself to a small table in a corner of her chamber, and one glance confirmed her suspicions. For half an hour she sat quietly thinking, considering many things that might prove very important in the near future. The chair girl knew little of life save what she had gleaned from books, but in some ways that was quite equal to personal experiences. At dinner she asked, "Did you take a book from my room today, Mary Louise?" "No," was the reply. "I've not been in your room since yesterday."
"Nor you, Aunt Hannah?"
"No, my dear. What book is missing?"
"It was entitled The Siberian Exile."
"Good gracious!" exclaimed Mary Louise. "Wasn't that the book you found the letter in?"
"Yes."
"And you say it is missing?"
"It has mysteriously disappeared."
"Nonsense," said Uncle Peter, who had returned with a fine string of trout. "No one would care to steal an old book, and the thing hasn't legs, you know."
"Nevertheless," said Irene gravely, "it is gone."
"And the letter with it," added Mary Louise regretfully. "You ought to have let me read it while I could, Irene."
"What letter are you talking about?" asked the lawyer.
"It is nothing important, Uncle Peter," Irene assured him. "The loss of the book does not worry me at all."
Nor did it, for she knew the letter was not in it, and to avoid further questioning on the part of Mr. Conant, she managed to turn the conversation to less dangerous subjects. End of chapter 16. Read by Sibella Denton. For more free audiobooks or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org.
Chapter 17 of Mary Louise by L. Frank Baum. Read for LibriVox.org into the public domain. Chapter 17. The Hired Girl. Mr. Conant had just put on a comfortable smoking jacket and slippers, and seated himself in the den, pipe in hand, when the old-fashioned knocker on the front door of the lodge began to bang. It banged 3 times, so Mr. Conant rose and made for the door. Mrs. Conant and Mary Louise were in the kitchen, and Irene was in her own room. The lawyer reflected, with a deprecating glance at his unconventional costume, that their evening caller could be none other than their neighbor, the beautiful Miss Lord, so as he opened the door he regretted that his appearance was not more presentable. But it was not Miss Lord who stood upon the porch awaiting admittance. It was a strange girl, who asked in a meek voice, "Is this Hillcrest Lodge?"
"It is," replied the lawyer.
The girl came in without an invitation, bringing a carpet-bag in one hand, and a bundle tied in a newspaper tucked under the other arm. As she stood in the lighted room, she looked around inquiringly and said, "I am Sarah Judd. Where is Mrs. Morrison, please?" Mr. Conant stood and stared at her, his hand clasped behind his back in characteristic attitude. He could not remember ever having heard of Sarah Judd. "Mrs. Morrison," he said in his choppy voice, "is in Europe." The girl stared at him in return as if stupefied. Then she sat down in the nearest chair and continued to stare. Finding her determined on silence, Mr. Conant spoke again. "The Morrisons are spending the summer abroad. I and my family are occupying the lodge in their absence. I am Mr. Conant of Dorfield." The girl sighed drearily. She was quite small, about 17 years of age, and dressed in a faded gingham, over which she wore a black cloth coat that was rusty and frayed. A black straw hat, fearfully decorated with red velvet and mussed artificial flowers, was tipped over her forehead. Her features were not bad, but her nose was blotched, her face strongly freckled, and her red hair very untidy.
Only the mild blue eyes redeemed the unattractive face. Eyes very like those of Mary Louise in expression, mused Mr. Conant, as he critically eyed the girl.
"I have come here to work," she said after a long pause, during which she seemed trying to collect her thoughts. "I'm Sarah Judd. Mrs. Morrison said I must come here on Saturday, the 10th day of July, to go to work. This is the 10th day of July."
I see. When did Mrs. Morrison tell you that?"
"It was last September."
"Oh, so she hired you a year in advance and didn't tell you, afterward, that she was going abroad?"
"I didn't see her since, sir."
Mr. Conant was perplexed. He went into the kitchen and told Aunt Hannah about it, and the good woman came at once to interview Sarah Judd, followed by Mary Louise, who had just finished wiping the dishes. "This seems very unfortunate for you," began Mrs. Conant, regarding the strange girl with mild interest. "I suppose, when Mrs. Morrison engaged you, she expected to pass the summer at the lodge, and afterwards she forgot to notify you." Sarah Judd considered this soberly, then nodded her head. "I've walked all the way from Millbank," she said with another sigh.
"Then you've had nothing to eat," exclaimed Mary Louise with ready sympathy. "May I get her something, Aunt Hannah?"
"Of course, my dear." Both Mr. and Mrs. Conant felt rather embarrassed. "I regret," said the latter, "that we do not need a maid here at present. We do our own housework, you see."
"I have left a good place in Albany to come here," said Sarah, plaintively.
"You should have written to Mrs. Morrison," declared the lawyer, "asking if she still required your services. Many unforeseen things happened during a period of 10 months."
"Mrs. Morrison, she have paid me a month in advance," asserted the girl, in justification, "and she paid me my expenses to come here, too. She said I must not fail her. I should come to the lodge on the 10th of July and do the work at the lodge. She did not say she would be here, and she did not say you would be here. She told me to come and work, and she paid me a month in advance, so I could give the money to my sister, who needed it then. And I must do as Mrs. Morrison says. I am paid to work at the lodge, and so I must work at the lodge. I cannot help that, can I?"
The lawyer was a man of experience, but this queer complication astonished him. He exchanged a questioning glance with his wife. "In any event," said Mrs. Conant, "the girl must stay here tonight, for it would be cruel to ask her to find her way down the mountain in the dark. We will put her in the maid's room, Peter, and tomorrow we can decide what to do with her."
"Very well," agreed Mr. Conant, and retreated to the den to have his smoke.
Mary Louise arranged some food on the table for Sarah Judd, and after the girl had eaten, Mrs. Conant took her to the maid's room, which was a very pleasant and well-furnished apartment quite in keeping with all the comfortable appointments at Hillcrest Lodge, although it was built behind the kitchen and it formed a little wing of its own. Sarah Judd accepted these favors with meek resignation. Since her one long speech of explanation she had maintained silence. Leaving her in her room, the family congregated in the den, where Mr. Conant was telling Irene about the queer arrival and the unfortunate misunderstanding that had occasioned it.
"The girl is not to blame," said Mary Louise. "She seems an honest little thing, resolved to do her duty. It is all Mrs. Morrison's fault."
"Doesn't look a very competent servant, either," observed Mr. Conant, comfortably puffing his pipe.
"You can't tell that from appearances, Peter," replied Mrs. Conant. "She can at least wash dishes and sweep and do the drudgery. Why not keep her?"
"Oh, my dear!"
"Mrs. Morrison has paid her a month's wages, and Molly Morrison wouldn't have done that had the girl not been competent. It won't cost us anything to keep her, except her food, and it seems a shame to cast her adrift just because the Morrisons forgot to notify her they had changed their plans."
"Also," added Mary Louise, "Sarah Judd will be useful to us. This is Aunt Hannah's vacation, as well as a vacation for the rest of us, and a rest from cooking and housework would do her a heap of good."
"Looking at it from that viewpoint," said Peter, after puffing his pipe reflectively, "I approve of our keeping Sarah Judd. I believe it will please the Morrisons better than for us to send her away, and it surely won't hurt Hannah to be a lady of leisure for a month or so."
End of chapter 17. Read by Sibella Denton. For more free audiobooks or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org.
Chapter 18 of Mary Louise by L. Frank Baum. Read for LibriVox.org into the public domain. Chapter 18. Mary Louise Grows Suspicious. And so Sarah Judd's fate was decided. She prepared their Sunday morning breakfast and cooked it quite skillfully. Her appearance was now more tidy, and she displayed greater energy than on the previous evening, when doubtless she was weary from her long walk. Mrs. Conant was well pleased with the girl, and found the relief from clearing the table and doing the dishes very grateful. Their Sunday dinner,
which Sarah prepared unaided and served promptly at 1 o'clock, their usual hour, was a pleasant surprise to them all. "The girl is a treasure," commented Mrs. Conant, contentedly. Sarah Judd was not talkative. When told she might stay, she merely nodded her red head, displaying neither surprise nor satisfaction. Her eyes had a habit of roving continually from face to face and from object to object, yet they seemed to observe nothing clearly, so stolid was their expression. Mary Louise tried to remember where she had noted a similar expression before, but could not locate it. Miss Lord came over that afternoon, and when told about the new maid and the manner of her appearance, seemed a little startled and uneasy. "I must see what she looks like," said she, "for she may prove a congenial companion for my own maid, who is already sulking because the place is so lonely." And presently Sarah Judd came out upon the lawn to ask Mrs. Conant's further instructions, and this gave Agatha the desired opportunity to examine her closely. The inspection must have been satisfactory, for an expression of distinct relief crossed the lovely face. That Saturday evening they all went down to the Bigby place in Miss Lord's motor car, where the lady entertained her guests at a charming luncheon. The Bigby place was more extensive than Hillcrest Lodge, as it consisted of a big, rambling residence and numerous outbuildings, but it was not nearly so cozy or homelike, nor so pleasantly situated. Miss Lord's maid, Susan, was somewhat a mystery to the Hillcrest people. She dressed almost as elaborately as her mistress, and performed her duties grudgingly and with a scowl that seemed to resent Miss Lord's entertaining company. Stranger still, when they went home that night, it was the maid who brought out the big touring car and drove them all back to Hillcrest Lodge in it, handling the machine as expertly as Agatha could do. Miss Lord pleaded a headache as an excuse for not driving them herself. Sarah Judd opened the door for them. As she stood under the full light of the hall lamp, Mary Louise noticed that the maid Susan leaned from her seat in the car and fixed a shrewd glance on Sarah's unconscious face. Then she gave a little shake of her head and drove away. "There's something queer about the folks at Bigby's," Mary Louise confided to Irene, as she went to her friend's room to assist her in preparing for bed. "Agatha Lord kept looking at that velvet ribbon around your neck tonight, as if she couldn't keep her eyes off it, and this afternoon she seemed scared by the news of Sarah Judd's arrival, and wasn't happy until she had seen her. Then again, that queer maid of Agatha's, Susan, drove us home so she could see Sarah Judd for herself. How do you account for all that, Irene?" "I don't account for it, my dear. You've been mixed up with so many mysteries that you attach suspicion to the most commonplace events. What should there be about Sarah Judd to frighten anyone?" "She's a stranger here, that's all, and our neighbors seem suspicious of strangers. I'm not questioning poor, innocent Sarah, understand, but if Agatha and her maid are uneasy about strangers coming here, it seems likely there's a reason for it." "You're getting morbid, Mary Louise. I think I must forbid you to read any more of my romances," said Irene lightly, but at heart she questioned the folks at Bigby's as seriously as her friend did. "Don't you think Agatha Lord stole that missing book?" asked Mary Louise, after a little reflection. "Why should she?" Irene was disturbed by the question, but was resolved not to show it. "To get the letter that was in it, the letter you would not let me read." "What are your affairs to Agatha Lord?" "I wish I knew," said Mary Louise musingly. "Irene, I've an idea she came to Bigby's just to be near us. There's something stealthy and underhanded about our neighbors, I'm positive. Miss Lord is a very delightful woman on the surface, but—" Irene laughed softly, as if amused. "There can be no reason in the world, Mary Louise," she averred, "why your private affairs are of interest to outsiders, except—well, Irene? Except that you are connected, in a way, with your grandfather." "Exactly. That is my idea, Irene. Ever since that affair with O'Gorman, I've had a feeling I was being spied upon." "But that would be useless. You never hear from Colonel Weatherby, except in the most roundabout ways." "They don't know that. They think I might hear, and there's no other way to find out where he is. Do you think," she added, "the Secret Service employs female detectives?" "Perhaps so. There must be occasions when a woman can discover more than a man." "Then I believe Miss Lord is working for the Secret Service, the enemies of Grandpa Jim." "I can't believe it." "What is on that black ribbon around your neck?" "A miniature of my mother." "Oh, tonight it got above your dress, the ribbon, I mean, and Agatha kept looking at it." "A good detective wouldn't be caught doing such a clumsy thing, Mary Louise. And even if detectives were placed here to watch your actions, they wouldn't be interested in spying upon me, would they?" "I suppose not." "I have never even seen your grandfather, and so I must be exempt from suspicion. I advise you, my dear, to forget these apprehensions, which must be purely imaginary. If 1,000 spies surrounded you, they could do you no harm.
nor even trap you into betraying your grandfather, whose present location is a complete mystery to you." Mary Louise could not help admitting this was true, so she kissed her friend good-night and went to her own room. Left alone, Irene put her hand to the ribbon around her neck, and drew from her bosom an old-fashioned oval gold locket, as big as any ordinary watch, but thinner. She opened the front of the ease and kissed her mother's picture, as was her nightly custom. Then she opened the back and drew out a tightly folded wad of paper. This she carefully spread out before her, when it proved to be the old letter she had found in the book. Once again she read the letter carefully, poring over the words in deep thought. "This letter," she murmured, "might indeed be of use to the government, but it is of far more value to Mary Louise and to her grandfather. I ought not to lose it, nor ought I to let anyone read it at present. Perhaps, if Agatha Lord has noticed the ribbon I wear, it will be best to find a new hiding-place for the letter." She was in bed now, and lay looking around the room with a speculative gaze. Beside her stood her wheeled chair, with its cushion of dark Spanish leather. The girl smiled, and reaching for her work-basket, which was on a stand at the head of the bed, she drew out a pair of scissors and cut some of the stitches of the leathern cushion. Then she tucked the letter carefully inside, and with a needle and some black linen thread sewed up the place she had ripped open. She had just completed this task when she glanced up and saw a face at her window, indistinctly, for even as she raised her head it drew back and faded into the outer gloom. For a moment Irene sat motionless, looking at the window. Then she turned to the stand, where the lamp was, and extinguished the light. An hour later, perhaps, she sat upright in bed, considering what she should do. Then again she reached out in the darkness and felt for her scissors. Securing them, she drew the chair-cushion upon the bed, and felt along its edge for the place she had sewn. She could not determine for some time which was the right edge, but at last she found where the stitches seemed a little tighter drawn than elsewhere, and this place she managed to rip open. To her joy she found the letter and drew it out with a sigh of relief. But now what to do with it was a question of vital importance. She dared not relight her lamp, and she was helpless when out of her chair. So she put back the cushion, slid from the bed into the chair, and wheeled herself in the dark to her dresser, which had a chenille cover. Underneath this cover she spread the letter, deeming that so simple a hiding-place was likely to be overlooked in a hasty search, and feeling that the letter would be safe there for the night, at least. She now returned to her bed. There was no use trying to re-sew the cushion in the dark. She lay awake for some time, feeling a certain thrill of delight in the belief that she was a conspirator, despite her crippled condition, and that she was conspiring for the benefit of her dear friend Mary Louise. Finally, she sank into a deep slumber, and did not waken till the sun was streaming in at the window, and Mary Louise knocked upon her door to call her. "You're lazy this morning," laughed Mary Louise, entering. "Let me help you dress for breakfast." Irene thanked her. No one but this girl was ever permitted to assist her in dressing, as she felt proud of her ability to serve herself. Her toilette was almost complete when Mary Louise suddenly exclaimed, "Why, what has become of your chair cushion?" Irene looked toward the chair. The cushion was gone. "Never mind," she said, although her face wore a troubled expression. "I must have left it somewhere. Here, I'll put a pillow in its place until I find it." End of chapter 18. Read by Sibella Denton. For more free audiobooks or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org.